Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
G'day, gladdies and potties, and welcome to some of the best of Late Night Live on ABC Radio National Summer. Now, you may not have heard this program last year, and you could be in for a bit of a shock because, oh dear, the entire program is devoted to sport. Yep, let me tell you, this has hardly ever happened before with this program. Once we almost managed to do a show with Pelé, and I think about 16 years ago I did get an interview with Maradona, but that's it. But on this occasion, I strayed from the anti-football league path for a very good reason, and that was to talk to one of the most celebrated figures in the Australian Football League, Kevin John Sheedy. And I acknowledge that he's probably a major reason for my lack of success in dissuading people about football. But beyond the football field, Kevin and I share similar backgrounds. We both grew up in Melbourne. I'm 7 years older than him, but after moving off the little family farm at age 10, I moved to Richmond, went to the local Richmond State School, had a paper round in Richmond, used to get fivepence a dozen for flogging the Melbourne Herald, and at night I'd drift down to the poor relation to the MCG, the Richmond Football Club, and I'd sell papers to the team members, to the likes of Captain Blood, Jack Dyer. I'd go into the changing rooms and sell them to all these huge nude gentlemen who were sort of just jumping out of the shower. I was a fanatic supporter of Richmond. I had this yellow and black gear, funny berets, bags, scarves. It was only later that I fell out of love with football, and Keith Dunstan and I got involved in something called the Anti-Football League. Keith, a very famous journalist at The Sun in Melbourne, so yes, there was a time when I was into footy, and in particular, into Richmond. Kevin Sheedy has been involved in footy nearly as long as I haven't, 27 years as coach of Essendon, 250 games as a player for Richmond. Mind you, he's a plumber by trade, and as you'll learn, something of a social engineer. I took Kevin back to Christmas 1947 when he was new to the world and asked him to tell us about his childhood.
Childhood to me was pretty exciting because there was lots of people, lots of kids around in the in that late 40s, early 50s period. It was obviously an after-war period, and most likely, you know, myself and my brothers and sisters were after-war thoughts. But
how many
Seven, seven, right. Seven kids in the family.
Good Catholic family.
Yeah, no, we lived up the road from St. Joseph's, and that was opposite the jam factory just in Chapel Street there, which is now a little icon of Chapel Street as a building. But in those days, it was really pleasant. It was a sort of, you know, everybody from everywhere come to live in the area, a lot of Italian people, a lot of Maltese, a lot of Egyptians.
We should point out that we're talking of a time when the inner suburbs of Melbourne hadn't been gentrified, but they were still absolutely working class.
Yeah, absolutely. No doubt about that. You know, I mean, not only that, but in that time as a paper boy going through myself, many of the houses got pulled down and put commission flats up, and they are still there just off Chapel Street near Malvern Road. So, you know, people think now, obviously, of South Yarra connected to Toorak, connected to Malvern and Armidale, but for many, many decades, there's a streamline of poverty in that area, for sure.
And we were looked down on, weren't we, by the rest of wider Melbourne, because this was sort of pretty grotty stuff.
Well, and at times, you don't realise that, you know, when you're going through, because you don't know that much else anyway, really, when you think about it. There was Toorak and nothing else. The greatest block of land in that area was the Botanic Gardens. And we spent a lot of time fishing in the Botanic Gardens.
Mm. You were a paperboy too. What did you get a dozen, do you remember?
Look, I think it probably might have been a shilling. The best money you made were tips. It wasn't more really about selling how many papers you sold, your tips. See, the person that worked in everyday life, the labour force, they'd get off the tram, they'd run up a bill of a Herald each night, and that's one on threepence by the end of the week, and then you would drop the Herald and Globe off on a Saturday night on the way home, and they will give you 5 shillings. Well, that was enough for the week.
Yeah.
And if you got, say, 6 clients or customers like that, you're a pretty well-off little paper boy.
No one realises what a dangerous profession it was, because you had to jump off and on and off trams, yeah, didn't you?
Sensational.
And it's where your often time pissing comes down on you. It's wet and cold. And
Look, I mean, if I had my life again, I wouldn't change it, I'll be honest, because it was just such a learning experience of getting to know people. Of course, when I ended up getting in my own hotel, which is big, it's pretty similar to, you know, that wonderful little game show out of America, England, with Paul Mall and Trafalgar Square. But when you've got your own hotel as a paper boy, you connected to people.
Did you have to fight for your posse? I had to fight for my corner.
Yeah, corner. Yeah. Well, you had to fight for a corner, but if you did 4 years, you got a hotel. And that was you did your time.
What about racial relations? You're talking about the beginning of the post-war immigration's off and running.
Yeah.
And
it is again.
And is again. Yeah. Different people, different countries. But there was a fair bit of tension, I recall. You know.
There was a lot of tension, particularly with the Italian people, because, you know, and German people, because we had been at war with them. And no one understood that. Not everybody really on either side liked being at war, and obviously with Germany and Hitler and that regime, I mean, Australian people didn't understand that many Germans really didn't want to be at war along with the Italians. Mussolini obviously brought them into it. So in the end, we had 9 or 10 Italian young men living over across the road from us, and my father struggled with that. He did struggle with it.
Later on, you and I are going to talk about your interest in Aboriginal issues, but this is something we have in common. I'd never met an Aborigine when I was a kid.
Well, you wouldn't in inner suburbs in Richmond. And
you hadn't either, had you?
No, I hadn't. I mean, look, clearly the first time I set eyes on Indigenous Australian people was probably television. And we're talking 1956 or 7, going to around 60-year period, when a guy called George Bracken turned up in the boxing arena. And George Bracken is one of the best-looking men I'd ever seen in regard to, I probably would have been 13. He would have obviously been in his 20s. He was an Australian champion. And not only that, but 2 years ago I invited him to an Essendon Sydney game, because he now works in Sydney with the police and helping with some of the issues. And it was just great to sort of, in 2006 or 5, I think it was, take George Bracken out for lunch and come to a game of AFL, because, you know, he was one of my early idols. And that's the first time I ever saw an Aboriginal person.
And he'd be, how old would he be now?
Look, I think he's somewhere in his 70s, and he's looking absolutely sensational. If you ever got to see this man, well-spoken, classy sort of guy, I think to myself, gee, you should be very proud of the way you've conducted yourself through your life. Pretty similar to Tom Hafey, in the spirit of looking after yourself and health. So we got him up, the Bombers invited him to a match, and it was a tough little game, and he invited, and then I haven't seen him since, but I have enjoyed the journey, because it was a bit of a thank you.
This isn't a clumsy attempt at a pun, but when did football kick in with you? When did you discover football?
Well, it kicked in with myself and my brother, Patrick. He was a very, very good player, and he just wanted somebody to play footy with, so, you know, you're sort of like the spare chair around the house, aren't you? You sort of obviously helped out. He was a fantastic coach, even though we didn't realise at that time, but he actually was a better player. So you're trying to beat somebody better than him. And, of course, his backyard footy and street football. And I think in the end, just the kids, you know, that we all played, you know.
Where did you actually play? Where
on the streets.
Just on, literally on the streets?
Faulkner Park and on the streets.
Yeah, Faulkner Park.
And on the streets, yeah. Mainly on the streets, because, you know, no one had cars in those days virtually, except maybe a couple of people in the street. So
good point. It was really quite a safe place, wasn't it?
A very safe place. You might have got hit by a horse. Because, you know, the milk cart had a horse.
The bread cart, the ice cart, the bottle cart.
So there were four horses running around, and the quickest race we used to see in the street is everybody going out to get the horse shit, to shovel it, to put it in the garden. So it was quite amazing. But I'm talking really sort of mid-50s here, and just to get their garden to get some little bit of, you know, extra vitamin into their flowers and their little patches. Quite amazing. But very, very funny.
Did you have a billy cart?
Oh, obviously. The biggest.
The biggest.
No, when I say the biggest fun, dangerous fun, was a billy cart. Because Punt Road Hill, was the danger one.
It's the biggest hill in Melbourne, isn't
and
it?
You've
it's
got
the Everest of hills down here.
If you could get there after
you need oxygen and a Sherpa.
You would get to church as early as possible and then meet the guys at the top of Punt Road Hill and you are taking it in the breeze, and it was just super dangerous.
It was also a good tool to have because I used to sell footy records outside the MCG, Adam Abele card. After the match, you'd sneak in and get the empty bottles. And I'd take a Abele card with empties to get the deposits from the milk bars in Bridge Road.
See, I hadn't thought of that.
But you
wish you had told me earlier.
tell us about Tom, your dad.
Dad was your typical Irish sort of... Father, he very strict Catholic, you know, very strict Catholic, and Mum wasn't.
She was Catholic, but not strict.
Not strict. Mum came from Sunbury, and Dad came basically. His parents came out from Ireland, moved. They started really their life in Yarrawonga, along the Murray, and then moved down to a place called Bruthen, just out of Bairnsdale. And of course, our best holidays of all time would actually go up there in the Mozzie Face flat and pick and the maize and you know, the cabbages and potatoes and that. So we had a great time. You know, it was just different, but it was great.
I remember this time as the division between proddies and micks.
Serious.
It was Belfastian. You know, and if you went to a state school and there was a Catholic school within eyeshot, you'd be yelling out, Catholic dogs stink like frogs, jumping out a hole of logs, and the Catholic kids would sing back, state, state, full of hate.
Mm.
That's gone now, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's good. And it had to, and it needed to. I mean, obviously, you know, with probably when you think back in history and you look at all the changes that have come across the landscape, we probably, if we don't start talking to each other, we're surrounded by 200 million Muslims, you want to start talking to each other.
We'll get on to that later. Tell us about Reen, your mum, who died quite recently.
Yeah, mum died. Dad died at 50. So mum, she died at 82, 2 years ago.
He died at 50?
Yeah, so mum was left with 7 kids, and that was a sort of a tough little upbringing for her. But out of that, we found a great mother watching her go through those decades of not having a husband. She never remarried, and she said, "Why would you? I had 7 with the first one." And I thought that was quite a smart answer.
Well, Reen was an inspiration for a book of yours a few years ago, Football's Women, The Forgotten Heroes.
Yeah, well, it was clearly, I think, it was a situation at Essendon that we sat down and discussed what women had to do with football. And really, when you think about it, with husband and father out at work often, and the role the mother plays, and we never really got to sit down and discuss or debate that. And so, you know, Joyce Brown's daughter and myself, Carolyn, we travel Australia, and we basically spoke to a lot of women. Carolyn did a lot of the lead work. She went to Ireland and spoke to Jim Stein's mother and what it's like to lose a son from Ireland to go and play the strange game of football called Aussie Rules, you know. So it was something I felt strongly about, and we did it.
Is it true that more women are involved in Aussie Rules than the other codes?
I would think so, yeah. And I think it's even more so now because of AusKick. I think the AFL have got a very, very good strong leg in with AusKick, which is a junior development grade of parents involved, fathers and mothers, in their kids' development of Australian football right from the age of sort of 6, 7, 8.
I was talking about this era with a mutual friend of ours, Warwick Hadfield, with whom you wrote a book. Here it is, The 500 Club for His Greatest Coaches. And I was remembering what it was like in, say, Richmond or Collingwood when the team won, euphoria.
Hmm.
And what it was like when the team lost, desolation. Hmm. You know, the flags would go to half-mast, people would be jumping off buildings. Does that still happen now when it's not as locked to a suburb as it used to be?
Look, I think there's been a bit of movement in that sort of feeling from a point of difference that the city's grown into such a huge city, and probably the same with rugby and rugby league, obviously, in Sydney and Brisbane. But I was only in Brisbane talking to the rugby club last week on the weekend off, Brisbane Rugby Club. But in our situation, we've moved out of Richmond and we've moved out of Essendon a bit. Richmond probably more so because it's next to the city. I mean, how many Melbourne fans can live in Melbourne that's actually a city now? So they've all moved and dispersed. So I think it's probably watered down a little, but the passion of losing and the disappointment in it is very, very much still there, because whilst you might have moved a distance, emails are very close to you.
The voice of Kevin Sheedy, former player for Richmond, coach of Essendon. This is the best of Late Night Live on ABC Radio National Summer, Radio Australia, ABC Online, and downloadable onto your pod. Your first footy coach, you say, I've done some research here, at primary school was a woman. How could that be?
Well, the nuns ran the school, the presentation nuns, and her name was Nolan, and they were very, very good people. They loved sport. Her brother became an AFL umpire later on in his years. So, you know, she was fantastic, because really she turned up and took the kids down to Fortner Park to play and play against other schools. And that's all you really needed, somebody to actually take an interest in. And she was absolutely wonderful.
So there you are. You're playing for Richmond Tigers. We're moving the story along. At the age of 19, you go from playing in a grand final on a Saturday into the army on the Monday. I was balloted out, but you were a Nasho, so you went straight in.
Well, that was a 69 premiership, so Monday you never got any really much of an opportunity to enjoy the premiership. We played Carlton, and of course it was a tight grand final, with Carlton being ahead for fairly most of the match, and we got up in the last quarter and won. But look, the army I found fantastic. I mean, I got my first coaching job in the army by a major there called Major Fiddock, and he did a deal with me and said, look, you look after our troops, and we'll make sure you get the opportunity to go to training.
You spent a bit of time at Singleton, which is just down the road from where I live these days.
I nearly got killed in Singleton. I just fell asleep and hit three poles, and on the way to Casula SME, which is out near Liverpool.
Three poles, not one.
No, well, it was a deep sleep, but I'm very, very lucky. But I just didn't take the turn with the car, couldn't manage it by myself.
Dear, oh, dear. And
so I know Singleton well. I was stranded there one night about, you know, midnight, and trying to get to be on parade at SME Casula, which is west of Sydney. And so I was in the engineers in those days.
This could have been a posthumous interview. this could have been another first for me.
Yeah.
So, okay, because you're a plumber, you get into a squad of engineers who work on airports and bridges and roads.
We built an airport at Pakapanyal.
Well, I remember that was its full name was Pakapakapanyal.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of that.
Yeah, okay. So, and you defuse bombs?
And created plastic gel ignite, and we, you know, look, it was a really an exciting learning curve. Because you were coming out of something like tradesman area, 5 years on the building sites, like the place across the road here right now, and it was a different language from growing up in the Catholic school, I must admit. I finished my trade, I played in a grand final, and I moved into, yes sir, three bags full, and don't even blink at me, Sheedy, otherwise you'll be in that mess for about a week, and then we'll put you on yard duty for a week, and then you'll never see the side of a VFL ground as long as your backside points the ground. So,
but you responded to this culture.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a tough culture, but it was exciting because you met so many people from all around Australia, and let's face it, if you're looking at 1969-70, not many Australians moved. No one hardly flew anywhere.
That's right.
No one would have been to, say, Darwin or Alice Springs in the 60s when I went in the army. People just didn't fly. They didn't have the money. And, of course, by the time I got into football and got out of the army and started to move around, I actually got a hunger to see and want to see my country.
Did you have a view about the Vietnam War? Because most of your generation was protesting it.
I had no idea why we were there, I'll be honest. Looking back, and even then, I didn't even know where Vietnam was. I didn't know what about Saigon, or, you know, I actually went back to school in the army. I thought, well, if I've missed out on this war, because I was withdrawing at that stage back to Australia, and you're meeting a lot of people fairly stressed out about it, why the hell, where is it? And I thought, so I did Asian history and economics at night school in the army, just to cover a lack of education, which probably at the time, you know, mum was left with seven kids, so I had to get a job. So I thought I'll go back and have a look at maybe some areas where I might have wanted to find out with Asia and also economics.
So how old were you when you formally left school?
I left school in about 15 and a half, yeah.
Same as me.
I don't think it was that bad, actually. I liked school, but I didn't mind leaving it.
It's interesting that you coached an army side at Pakafakan Banyul, and that meant coaching and motivating blokes who were your military superiors, some of whom, of course, had seen the really ugly side of war.
Hmm.
And this required a bit of finessing, or you had to make mental adjustments. You couldn't go out and scream at them to, you know, to show some guts and some courage, because
Very difficult when you're 20, 21. You're moving into a situation where I had no understanding of diplomacy whatsoever, so I looked it up in the dictionary and, you know, you're trying to find out, well, how am I going to approach a major or a captain or a lieutenant and an RSM, and they're on the half-back flank and they won't pick up their opponent. So really in the end it was, you know, I thought to myself, well, I can't say what I felt, but I need to get a point across. And so that's probably the first area of diplomacy that I would ever have had to think about.
But I know that in your mind, because once again Warwick's told me this, that you had in your mind that some of these blokes had carried their dead mates out of the jungles of Vietnam.
Well, some of them are very sad people. And obviously, it's probably sometimes like the, you know, the generations at the present time that we're, the Y generation and the baby boomer generation. Well, you won't understand, pal. You'll never understand. And that's what they get. And you get that thrown in your face.
Mm.
Because how could you? So what you did was the best way is to try to at least show that you did understand. But I can understand where they were coming from.
How would you feel about the idea of national service now?
Look, I actually think that national service was fantastic. I would have it for 12 months and to have in this country about looking after people that need to be looked after in this country, particularly elderly people, particularly areas of grave concern in this country.
So you're not talking about belting off to Iraq and Afghanistan?
No, not
necessarily.
You're talking about, I think, service they're for professional soldiers. If the people that actually went in for 12 months at least wanted to then join the regular forces and be a professional soldier, male or female, then that's their prerogative. But I think our youth don't actually get a form of discipline that you actually need a bit of. Not everyone, but I think it wouldn't be that bad.
Okay, now this is an interesting moment for you and I, because we're dealing with command, military command. We're dealing with concepts of leadership, and you using the word discipline. In the army, it is imposed. In the army, there are people who are your superiors.
Correct.
But there is a difference I've always observed in my brief time in the army, but also in life in general, between command and leadership. You know, leadership is something
that's
that
like
people assume,
yeah.
And command is something that's imposed. Yeah. When did you realise that you could be a leader? Because that's what you've been.
Look, I probably just grew along watching people develop. I think that probably Richmond, very early days, sent me to the YMCA. They sent me to public speaking school when I was 19. And then
this is the football team, dude.
Yeah, yeah.
Really?
Yes, Graham Richmond and Ian Wilson and people that were in that club, Tom Hafey, they felt that, and in many ways, by the time I came out of the army, I actually got a full-time development job going to talk to schools right throughout Melbourne, Australia. So at 24, I think about maybe 25 probably, I was actually often starting my own business in developing different types of training and regimens in school called, you know, clinics and youth development programs.
So you discovered, or it evolved in
yes.
you, an ability to...
More an involvement.
To actually demand things of people.
Yes, in many ways you have to. You have to put your feeling and passion about what you believe in developing whatever little area of Australia that you could possibly develop with your intelligence. So I think in the end, that was the start of myself becoming a coach, because in that period between, say, 73 and 1980, when I got the Essendon coaching job, I would have probably done 2,000 clinics.
This is a good time to tell you that you're listening to the best of Late Night Live on ABC Radio National Summer, Radio Australia, ABC Online and via podcast. And I'm talking to Kevin Sheedy, coach of Essendon for the past 27 years, a true pioneer on and off the footy field. But now, dear Gladys, please be upstanding for the Essendon anthem.
See the bombers fly up, up to win the premiership flag. The boys who play this grand old game are always striving for glory and fame. See the bombers fly up, up.
That's all I can stand. Like most national anthems, footy anthems aren't too good, are they, really?
I think the Richmond song's a pretty good song.
Do you?
I think out of most of the club songs, I think they got a lot. When they sing that Richmond song and they've had wins, they sing it with a great deal of passion, the fans. And if of all the sports, I think that is one of the great songs of most of the songs of clubs in Australia.
But, mate, they are, in fact, derived, of course, aren't they, from...
Different. Yeah.
Popular, pre-existing
musicals
songs.
Whatever,
yeah.
Of course, yeah.
None of them come from hymns, which I would have thought you would have introduced to Essendon with you.
Yeah. I'd say Essendon's the right club to bring a hymn into it.
Get on to Cardinal Pell and see if he'd sort of let you have a hymn.
Well, I actually met Cardinal Pell last week. Three weeks ago in Sydney.
Yeah.
We had a photo together because there's a youth forum coming out next year to Australia, World Youth Forum. And I met them through one of the group's friends and the Ukrainian Association, which I spend a bit of time with.
Okay, Anzac Day. I understand that you developed this idea of the Anzac Day game.
Concept. Yes.
Yeah. Why? What did you want to do?
Well, clearly in the end it was... if you look at other sporting concepts or business concepts, which is the business side of football now, or sport, how can you generate... We have 11 home games, which is 22 hours of matches you actually own a year, only 22 hours.
Mm.
How can you actually develop that into something sensational instead of just doing a normal home and away game? So you look back in the history, and I often say people don't learn from history, that's what history tells you, but Tom Hafey came back to coach against Richmond in 1977. There was a match that I played in, and it was his first year at Collingwood, his first match ever to coach against Richmond, and 95,000 people turned up.
Wow.
So you saw the passion about Richmond and Collingwood going at each other with this one man.
Let's tell listeners who've got no idea about the physical proximity. We're talking about suburbs.
One end of a street.
At one
Hoddle
end of the
Street,
yeah.
And Punt Road. So we are talking 2 kilometres apart.
Yeah.
Now, clearly in the end, I've always loved Anzac Day. I mean, my father, you know, my uncle and my grandfather were in the army, and they went to two world wars. My father was in the army but didn't go to the world war. So I said, what can you do, being an ex-national service person, to thank? So I just rang Collingwood. I rang a guy called basically Gabby Allen, who's the manager of Collingwood, and said, can we get our presidents together and go and see Mr. Ruxton?
Now, Kevin, what you were after was a sort of an Anzac Day where people would do the dawn service, do the march, and then go to the footy.
And let's go to see a fantastic match for the RSL, not for footy in general.
Hmm.
It's a different concept. See, for many decades, the VFL and the RSL weren't actually dancing partners.
Is that right? No. I would have thought that you and Bruce were natural.
I mean, the money just bring your imagination into a match here.
Yeah.
So I'm talking about the VFL. And the RSL said, you will not play before.
Gotcha.
Okay. So we rang up and said, well, let's play a game for you. And the great march.
You'd learned some diplomatic skills by then, hadn't you?
Yeah. But look, it's been fantastic. And to ring Collingwood were the right club to ring.
You were in Europe recently. You went to a cemetery, the graves of soldiers killed in the Second World War.
Yeah, absolutely. That was at Cape Ferrat. It was quite amazing. I went there with a person that invited me over from after coaching the Australian team in Ireland, a gentleman by the name of Basil Sellers. And he took me around to the cemetery of soldiers. It was in one of the most picturesque parts of the Mediterranean coastline. And that little town of St. John Paul are an absolute icon of people to look after that cemetery so many decades after that war. It is absolutely spotless. And I just couldn't believe it. And it's amazing what you learn from people who care about what happened.
Many of the last surviving Anzacs who've now died would stress the horror and the futility of war. I remember going to my first Anzac Day march in Melbourne, and I realised it wasn't a hymn of praise to war. It was a day of grief.
Sorrow.
It was overwhelmingly sad, not triumphant.
No.
Yet these days there's a growing nationalistic, even jingoistic rallying around Anzac Day. It suits some people to market it that way.
No, I think,
Are you concerned by that?
No, I think it's about a thank you. And I don't think people say thank you enough. So to me it's all about thank you for the country you've given us and the opportunity. So that's the best way I can market thank you, and I don't think thank you's spoken enough.
So that's what the younger generations should take from Anzac Day?
Mm. Understand the history, and I'm glad to hear that the government's going to do something about looking at historical dates where young people should know in their educational brief. Not that I think everything in education is right, but I'm just saying I think that's important dates.
What are some of the others, Kevin? I don't want you to be date specific, but what are some of the other days in a nation's life that everyone should know about?
I think they should know about the real ships that got here, the courage. I think that we should look into the ridiculous reasons why some people were brought here more, about freedom more than just a pity of what they were brought out here for.
I think we're more aware, and I think also that
we should learn to understand both parties, our Indigenous Australians, better.
I didn't mean to interrupt, but it's always seemed to me that the people were more aware of our history of coming here in boats, often in hulks. We might be a bit more sympathetic towards more recent people coming here in boats as refugees.
No, many of them are very scared, frightened people. And one way I look at it, the other way, and obviously, I mean, there are devious people out there trying to get people here and making money out of it, so we don't appreciate that, neither does the Coast Guard, neither does the government. But is it quite amazing that they've picked Australia to travel from Persia all the way through the islands, the South Seas, and try to get to a huge island called Australia?
And many of them don't make it.
Of course, and we don't hear about them.
No, well, we heard about Civ X, of course, which was like a jumbo jet going down, over 300. Okay, I want to get on to the issue of Aboriginal players in the AFL, because this is central to what you've done, I think, with your life. But in parenthesis, I can remember as a kid hanging around Richmond Football Club, Jack Dyer telling me that football was the way that blokes during the Depression could make a few extra bob for the family. It was almost the only way out of, you know, the horrors of that. But the price that they paid was immense through injury. There wasn't a lot of great sports medicine around then, I guess. So
very little.
So a lot of blokes would be hobbling around in their 40s or 50s, right, having really wrecked themselves playing football.
So, no doubt about that. I think that the Coaches Association nominated an award to a person by the name of Dr. John Grant last year, a surgeon who had created, basically in this country, the opportunity to have knee reconstructions. And he operated in the 60s and was the first person to really, along with one or two others, to create an opportunity for people that when they hurt their knee, they could actually still have a career afterwards.
Mm.
And one of the clinic, if my memory sets me right, is a guy called John Townsend, one of Best and Fairest at Melbourne, say middle 60s, had a knee reconstruction and then come back and I think won another Best and Fairest about 3 or 4 years later. And that's the first time that anybody believed they could have a career after a knee operation.
I want to look at this area, though, of football being one of the ways out
of
working class or
poverty
or Indigenous poverty.
Mm.
Now, we know that there are a whole raft of sports in South Africa which you don't see black faces. You don't see too many black golf players out of South Africa or tennis players. They just weren't, they were too marginalised or kept out by apartheid. We also know that it took an awful long time for the United States to start admitting to even the possibility of a black playing baseball.
Top class sportsman.
Yeah. So, and it's always seemed to me that if you go back to our childhood, that there are only a couple of ways for a young Aboriginal kid to escape. One of them was through, of all things, the Jimmy Sharman boxing troupe.
Correct.
And the other was football.
The Chief Little Wolf and the rest.
Yeah.
Look, I think that you're right. There's no doubt about Jimmy Sharman. We used to go to the Royal Melbourne Show just to see some of the fantastic, courageous, pugilistic fights for kids. I mean, Mum and Dad said, don't ever go there. Well, it obviously meant you went. And, of course, we used to have a look, even to see their build and their muscles when you were 8 or 10 years of age and you're at the Royal Melbourne Show and you see, God, I'd love to have a chest or a bicep or a calf or, you know. So you're looking at the structure of the male being. But, look, I think that you made a comment then, and I hadn't thought about it, whether it's an opportunity to get Indigenous Australians out of a poverty-stricken area into some chance of a better life. And maybe, and I have not asked the players this, but maybe that is what they're seeing. You have an opportunity to be a 17-and-a-half-year-old Indigenous boy that could earn $50,000 in his first year and start assisting, helping his family. And I think that is the way the Indigenous families feel and think about their community.
For the last few years, we've taken the program up to the Garma Festival, which Mandawoy and his brother run. And the new go is music. There are 1,000 bands, it seems to be, right across the top end. Every little community's got 2 or 3 groups of kids playing rock or whatever, hip-hop, and they're bloody good. And the extraordinary thing, I remember Peter Garrett was up last time and he was astonished by this, was these little black kids can play everything. You know, they play the drums, they play the cornet, they play the guitar. They're sort of, you know, they're just terribly gifted. But the other thing they seem to like to do is kick a ball around.
Look, I think they're in love with our game of AFL as much as anything in their life. Last night I spoke at a function at the Sofitel, and it was about young Indigenous people that are brought from their communities to some of the top schools in each capital city in Australia. There was 150 there last night, and one of them was one of our great Polly Farmer, a great player in our game, his grandson. Many boys from, you know, the top of Australia going to schools in and around Sydney, Brisbane, Melbourne, Adelaide and Perth. But at the end of the night, this lovely 14-year-old young girl got up and played the violin. And I was just astonished. And I've just...
You got tears in your eyes.
Yeah, you, well, you just it. You just think to yourself, well, God, we've got to get these guys opportunities.
Yeah.
Simple as that.
Not much point of going to school. At the end of it, you can't get a job.
Exactly. You know, and I'll tell you what, my first person gave me a job was a guy called Paul Vincent. He had Vincent's Hardware and Chapel Street out there. I've never forgotten the man because he actually said yes. It's an amazing...
But you never forget your first boss. It's like your first girlfriend. That's an interesting point.
I'm not going there.
Okay. Well, no, I was going to ask you about that later. Okay. You're known as an honorary black fella, aren't you, up in Darwin?
I'm a life member of the Northern Territory Footy League, and I'm very proud of it because I promised them in 1974, if I ever, ever coached, I'll come back here with a team.
This is the best of Late Night Live, ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, ABC Online and via podcast, and my jockstrap is killing me. My first ever program with someone from the world of sport. His name is Kevin Sheedy, coach of Essendon for the past 27 years, although that was to end within hours of the interview. Was it my fault?
We talked about how, as kids hanging around Richmond, we didn't bump into too many Aboriginal kids.
No.
I can remember my first Aboriginal encounter, and that was at the Northbourne Sanctuary, which was this crappy little zoo where there's a couple of mouldy wombats and a couple of...
Northbourne.
And there was...
I can't wait to tell the people Northbourne there. Yeah.
Well, it's long gone, but yeah, it was a little terrible little local zoo. But they had a team of donkeys, and there was an Aboriginal bloke, inevitably called Jackie, who'd sort of pile you onto the donkey and pull you off at the other end. He was wonderfully grumpy and we're all terrified of him. It was the first time I'd ever seen a black face.
So, I mean, probably the first time. Well, the first time, like, I mean, when you sat down and tried to read the comic strips in the paper, and there was a comic strip in, I think, either the People or the Post in those days about an Indigenous person, right? And...
You're talking about Jolliffe's drawings of the community?
Yeah, well, yeah. just you saw a drawing of an Aboriginal having a chat with a skippy, which we would call an Anglo-Saxon, right?
Mm.
And I wonder what the hell was going on, because I just didn't understand that there was any black people or indigenous in this. I didn't even know that.
But as a Richmond boy, you must remember the Palaco sign.
Yeah, you always remember that.
Most of the listeners won't know what
you felt wealthy about, if you owned a Palaco shirt.
But the advertising was based on an Aboriginal bloke, big muscles, you know, naked except for a Palaco shirt, and he said, "Mine tinket they fit." Do you remember that?
I didn't know.
And there was a huge sign.
That's 6 years just before I arrived.
No, mate. It was around. You're repressing your memory. Anyway, so you get into this. Why do you think... I know the Irish and the Aborigines have always been incredibly close. It's astonishing to me how many of the Indigenous leaders have got Irish names.
Well, I've spoken at times to Michael Long, and I said, look, Michael, you know, just get a little bridge getting built here. Like, we'll just go for it. And I said, look, first of all, don't complain, because we come here in chains. You walked here. And he said, well, what do you mean by that? I said, well, you know, there were some people dragged here. You know, you actually found it at first and walked here and enjoyed it, because it was all connected without the water in the road, which is present in this state of period in life, in civilization. So now, go and study a bit before you actually think we're all tarred with the same brush. That sort of conversation. Right, and Okay. So in the end, it's sort of about, you don't only develop footballers, you've got to develop people and make them think about what they say and talk and fight for, or sit down and do nothing.
You talk about football as though it was a form of national service.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that idea either.
That's a serious point.
Well, I hadn't thought of it.
But you're thinking about discipline, about structure for lives, aren't you?
Yeah, well, some sort of structure. You don't want to manipulate the whole life into, you know, training. And I mean, I've been there for now over four decades, and really in the end it's been a marvellous education for myself without ever going to a university.
You brought Michael Long to Essendon from Darwin via West Torrens in 88, and at that time you were looking for new recruiting grounds because the Aussie Rules competition was going national.
Well, Noel Juggins, my recruiting staff, suggested that we sat down and thought, look, you know, we just changed in 87, the AFL changed, West Coast came in. Now, where are you going to find all these, you know, one, two, three new clubs they're thinking of doing? Where are you going to ring up and find 140 or 60 or 70 players? You just can't do that. They were not out there, let alone go and find the coaches to coach them. So they all had their own footy leagues. Were they as good as what was being played in Melbourne? Not many. Some of the players we bought over never made it, and they were the best players in Perth and basically Adelaide. So, gee, so it got to a situation where there's 500,000 Indigenous Australians.
Yes, the census figures are interesting.
Yeah, we don't seem to actually understand them, and they don't actually want to necessarily understand us. So can we actually build a bridge somewhere and say hello to them? It ended up coming out of the 88 Carnival.
What about the bigotry that an Aboriginal player can cop on the field? Certainly from other players on the field, and often from the grandstands.
Look, I think that's lessened, which is good. I think that it might not have lessened still in life, but... And I think it's got to be from both sides too. I think that both Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians have got to say, look, this is where we want to... If you want to go somewhere in the next 100 years, or even the next 40, 50 years to get it up and running, let's actually have some respect for what side of our life we've been brought up in and understand each other better, because we have not done that well. We have not done that well at all. And I'm talking mainly from both sides, but in particular, I think non-Anglo-Saxon, that side.
Yeah.
Non-Indigenous, sorry.
I understand there's now a special school in Perth set up for Aboriginal footballers.
Hmm. Well, Jared Neesham's running basically a program out of that. And to me, he's doing a marvellous job, and he's got some senior government assistance, which is excellent. We had 7 players, I think, drafted out of there in the last year. There hasn't been one school like that. Clontarf's the name of the school. It's an old, I think, Christian Brothers school, still operating through now, bringing many of these terrifically talented young kids into Perth to get to understand the city and then perhaps be involved in top-class level sporting competitions, boys and girls.
Kevin, how do you feel about the current federal intervention into the communities of the Northern Territory, many of which you know pretty well?
I'll be honest, I haven't not been up there in them lately, so I cannot talk about the late situations happen, but I haven't met a guy called Noel Pearson. I do like him. So I would listen to if he felt there was a necessity. My only concerns about it all happening is that, you know, it's happening before an election, and I don't like that reason. I mean, all these people, Labor and Liberal, have been around for 10 years, and it should have been done earlier.
Now
that's only my comment.
Well, it happens to be pretty much mine as well. Tell us about your latest potential recruits, because you're now recruiting young blokes from the Horn of Africa, and I understand amongst them is a young Muslim Bashar.
Yeah, well, Bashar Hooley is an interesting example of a kid and a family that come out here to fall in love with Australia and Australian football. He's a very talented young player. We put him in the first year for 2 or 3 weeks, dropped him for all, you know, the reasons of we don't think most of these kids can handle a whole season of AFL in their first year. He's got a great attitude, got a great sense of humour, understands the ockerism of Australian sort of sense of humour and can cope with all the fun of footy and the hardness and the discipline of it. But I would say if you rate a person's attitude to make it, he's going to be very, very high in any player I've ever met. Now,
Kevin,
whether he's good enough or not, I don't know.
What's going on in your mind here? Is this more the need to recruit more players? Is it shady social engineering? Or is it using footy to break down cultural barriers?
No, I think that this boy was always going to be drafted. That didn't matter. And we drafted him fairly late, which means that he was rejected by every club, maybe three times. So he's in the fourth selection in the fourth area of the. So, you know, he's got terrific kicking skills. He's got ball winning ability. So why not? You've got to go for it.
We were talking about ways out of grim backgrounds, ways out of ghettos, ways out of remote and impoverished communities. Football, boxing, music, whatever.
A crap life with your parents, maybe.
Even that, yes. Even that. What happens after the intense stardom, the celebration of these young blokes? Because it's the shelf life of an athlete is about that of yogurt.
Yeah. Well, I think that hopefully along the way, everybody that is developing these people, that other than just footballers only, then they actually become fantastic citizens. They actually have wonderful careers.
So they don't collapse, they don't fall over.
Well, we don't want them to, and I think the AFL actually is doing a fair bit of work to make sure they don't, and the Players Association.
So your job as a coach is not just to win the day, it's to win the life.
Basically, in the end, yes.
So you're a bit of a shrink as well.
Well, I hadn't been told that, but there will be periods of you thinking that you've got to be that, because you're working with so many different personalities, different reasoned personalities, and some are absolute superstars in their talent but not necessarily in their lifetime thinking. So and the other thing that management, and particularly say a club like Essendon, are they're looking at the overall person more than just the overall footy club. And I think that's one of the strengths of our club, and that's why we've probably got rated the best in the latest survey, that we have the best basically membership in this city.
Of course, going back to our childhood, there was never big money in football. It was just a modest payment on Saturday, helped you get through the depression. And you smoked behind the shelter shed at school. It wasn't the vast amounts of money on the one hand, it wasn't drugs on the other.
No.
I mean, we'd never heard of drugs, had we?
No, I think that was probably an Aspro or Bex powder, wasn't it? Something like that, when you look back in the old days. And but look, I think that when you see what's happened as the world's got closer through vision, because you can see any sport event happening in the world on your screen, then there's a cost for that. There's a payment for that, because you're bringing in the world audience. So there's advertising. So that's created a bank for the youth of today's sport. So it's obviously how and what they do with that money that they can possibly achieve to have some sort of financial security, number one. Number two, what is money anyway? How much do you want and how much do you need? I mean, you see a guy like Packer die, and where's money going
anyway? He had a very miserable life. I knew Packer very well.
Well, I don't know. Anyway. I mean, how much money do you need to have a life? I mean, I could walk out there, go across the road and have baked beans on toast and still feel pretty good about myself.
Yeah. Perfectly true. Perfectly true. Kevin, people who know you well call you the priest.
The priest.
They see the role you play in the community. I'm seeking redemption. Give me a reason that I should be out there encouraging people to get stuck into football.
I think it's very similar to why the value of sport is to a community of a community of the world. It's obviously the Olympic Games and the situation football. It gets people to talk about issues together with the football thrown in. I mean,
that's sort of an extra, is it?
Yes, it's an extra. And of course, I think it's a great opportunity, particularly in our game. The best thing that's happened in our game is men and women are now going to football and bringing their families, because we have seven of the greatest stadiums in the world for a population of half of California. So we actually can sit them in the stadium, have a chat, don't agree, that rule's wrong, I'll boo and hiss and yes and great and clap. So it's a great way to communicate with other people.
Kevin, as you said that, you started to glow and a halo started to shine, above your
don't
head.
Don't go there. Okay. Maybe I just believe in what I'm doing.
It's always a help,
isn't it? Helps, doesn't it?
Kevin, you're an interesting bloke. I've got to recruit new people to interview because we're run out. I've interviewed everyone else. I think the sporting area could be the go. Later on, will you give me a list of names?
Open up your eyes. Open your mind. We're okay. We're not gremlins down the bottom of Australia in a sports field.
That's the voice of a coach, you see. Coaches are different. Coaches are different.
Okay, that's why there's only a few.
Kevin, thanks for that. Kevin Sheedy, 27 years, coach of Essendon Bombers Football Club. Before that, 250 games for the Tigers. He's won a heap of premierships, a heap of respect on and off the field for his playing ability and, as you can hear, my dears, his humanity. And I thank him very much for coming in to talk to a sporting ignoramus. Kevin and I are going off to training. I'll catch us later.
And we need it.
We're from Tigerland. We never weaken till the final siren's gone. Like the tiger of old, we're strong and we're bold, for we're from Tiger. Yellow and black, we're from Tigerland.
Tune in for our next edition of The Best of LNL on ABC Radio National Summer to hear chats with two remarkable Indigenous Australians. Lila Watson is approaching 70 and has had a rich life of activism, academia and art, and who is also the auntie of my other guest, Tiger Bales. Tiger, the former chair of the New South Wales Land Council, a pioneer of Indigenous broadcasting and Father of the Year in 2003. So don't forget to come back. And the news is next on ABC Radio National.
ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.